My journey has been one of returning from the darkness and stepping out into the light once more. I'm Chance Lunsford. I'm also Logos Centrifugal. While you're sitting trying to figure that out,
this is my podcast.
Allegedly. Logos Centrifugal Podcast. I'm Chance Lunsford. I'm also Logos Centrifugal. Maybe you're also Logos Centrifugal. While you're trying to figure out what that even means and how to pronounce what it means to you, let me introduce today's special guest. I have with me my friend, the great, the mighty, the powerful, Adam Peled. Adam is a dude who I ran into on Twitter, and I became immediately fond of him because he kept calling me a genius. And from that point, I quickly learned that he's got quite a noggin on him. And we've had some conversations sort of off the Twitter platform where we first met. He's got a lot of really exciting projects going on. He's involved in quite a few very interesting things. And on top of that, he's a man with a family. He's very dedicated to that family. And we see eye to eye on a great many things. We're both sort of idea men and need to have the support of the detail men to get things done. Adam's involved in a lot of tech spaces. And some of the projects that he's working on we'll get into because they're very interesting and there's a lot of opportunity in the world and a lot of opportunity for maybe some people who are listening to this who are looking for a way to find their own way into the world. And with that sort of very vague and mysterious introduction, Adam, thank you for coming on the podcast. Welcome. And why don't you fill in the blanks about who you are and what you do a little bit more there?
Sure. I'm really happy to be in this podcast. I think more than a genius, you're a wizard. I said it a couple of times. I really think you are. It's a level. It's a different level than being just very smart. And I was immediately drawn to you. I don't know why, but I'm going with it with good vibrations around it. So a bit about myself. I live in Israel. I was born in a kibbutz, which is like the communism kind of way of living in Israel. Up until I was 15 years old, I milked cows and I was the whole village-like experience in Israel. Most Americans don't know how it's really like, but this was part of my life. But I always had another leg in the more city life in Israel. I had a large family also in the city. And about 15 years old, I moved to the city with my family, and basically switched gears or switched life. I was always interested in computers and technology, but it was more of a sideline thing. And as time progressed, it became more and more of a thing for me. And from a very early age, like 18 years old, I jumped into computers and started doing my thing around it. At the beginning, it was doing code and development for various companies in Israel. And over time, my passion was around making a change in the world and putting my dent in it. And the best way I saw to do it was through entrepreneurship. And this happened about 10 years ago. And over the past 15 years, this has been what I've been doing and trying to mix between technology and innovation, entrepreneurship, those mix of things. This is where my passion lies. I was always interested in doing several things at once, both to my benefit and to my hardship. But over the past years, I've been growing up in that sense and focusing more on the most important things or the things that create the most impact. And I love my family. I love my wife and my kids. I've known my wife since I was 18 years old, which is uncommon in Israel. I have two kids and the third on the way. I'm trying to balance things out. There's parts in me which are like, you could say a superposition or two things at once that I constantly work with. I don't feel like a strain holding those two mindsets, like being very passionate about the mission and goals and not forgetting the most important thing, which is your family, your closest circle. So that's kind of who I am in a nutshell.
So I think maybe I would like to talk a bit about the kibbutz, because I've often said that, or sort of laughed about the idea of a quote unquote communist country, because it's sort of missing the point. It's like, what do you mean a communist country? Do you know what a commune is? It's like a little small thing that's working together to live in harmony with each other. How can you have a communist country? What does that even mean? And I guess, you know, it's very people, much to their detriment, I think, people often forget how important their roots are, their sort of initial circumstances, and how much their lives are shaped both as a consequence and in response to those initial inputs, that initial environment. And I guess I'm wondering, in your case, because as you just sort of highlighted, service and family and making a positive difference in the world, those are all things that are central to what you're doing. And I wonder how sort of that communal upbringing, that village life upbringing has, and obviously that's a broad question, but I'm just sort of wondering some of the major ways in which that has influenced the way that you look at the world, and some of the ways in which you've kept that alive inside of you, and some of the ways in which you're responding maybe to some of the aspects of that life that you did not find optimal for what you're trying to do in the world.
Sure. So first of all, I agree. I think you can't escape your origins. One of my partners was very savvy, and I learned a lot from him. One of the first questions he asked someone new that he's going to work with or anything is, where are you from? Where were you born? It's unless something traumatic happened in your life, those roots are in you. So I totally agree on that. For me, my roots they're comprised of two things. One is the kibbutz way of living. And the second is my family, my mother and my father, and my brother, my siblings. So regarding the kibbutz itself, the kibbutz is a failed communist experiment in Israel. We can say that it failed because basically there are barely any kibbutzes left in Israel. And the few that are remaining are kind of like not really behaving per the ideology of communism. They're just titled the kibbutz, that's it. Nothing really relates to it. In the early days of the kibbutz, my older sister felt it more than me. You actually lived, like, as a young kid, you were going to sleep without your immediate family, which is, if you think about it nowadays, it's completely odd. I can't imagine my daughter not sleeping in the same roof as me. So this was an experience that she had. When I was growing up, it was no longer the case. But there were still elements of that social living. The most important aspect is you didn't think about money or work the same way that you do in everywhere else. Like, you get your money from the kibbutz system, in a way. My mother was a nurse in the kibbutz, and everybody pretty much gets the same distribution. Everybody pretty much gets the same services. So basically everything around goals or achievements is subsided almost to the minimum. You, as someone observing as a kid, I left there at 15 years old, so I didn't partake that much as an adult, but as a kid watching this surrounding, this is the natural way of how I grew up in, and watching people around me, this is how I imagine life is that It's okay. Materialism is not important. The group, the community where you live, this is what's important. Now, we were kind of an odd family in the kibbutz because my father worked outside of the kibbutz and I had other family outside of the kibbutz. So those two mentalities which I kept seeing, the outside life of the city, my mother and father taking us in holidays to the city to, do bowling and pay with money in restaurants, and my father taking trips abroad quite a bit. He was a personal coach. He trained many athletes. I had those two parts. This is one thing that affected my life, the materialism versus non-materialism. And the second was my family, which was very, very supportive. My father and my mother, to me and my younger brother and my older sister, were always in the mindset of, let's just support them. Let's not push our agendas. So as someone growing up, even if I screwed up, I wasn't like an out of control kid, which a lot of the people in the kibbutz were, because it's kind of like a free system. They're less constrained. I wasn't one of those, but even when I went too far, I always felt like I had very good support and very good ideology brought to me from my father and my mother. My mother gave me the most calming and relaxed mindset that I could ever hope to give any of my kids, myself. Like, almost anything that happens in my life, even if it's very hard, I'm very calm about it, like almost stoic, without learning how to be stoic. Like, it's something that she gave to me. And my father gave me, he's one of the most intellectual and smart people I know. So he always thinks about, he doesn't take things for granted. So I learned from him to question almost everything in reality, and also self-introspection. So those parts in me of materialism, non-materialism, and thinking about things deeper than their initial layers. Also, not losing yourself and keeping yourself in a calm state, in a relaxed state. Those are the things that shaped most of my of who I am. And there was two additional ingredients bringing me to who I am. One is a writer who is a bit controversial called Carlos Castaneda. Carlos,
yeah. What's up, Don Juan?
Yeah, exactly. So for me, I think it was less about Carlos and Don Juan, but mostly the time that it caught me. I was 16, 17 years old, teenager life, the usual searching for meaning kind of mindset. I wasn't the popular kid. I had a crush on a girl, the same story every teenager feels. And in that time, I don't know why, but he caught me, and I read like 8 or 10 of his books. And that flawless warrior mindset of his stuck with me even to today. So for me today, one of those aspects of being true to your core, to yourself, seeing the addictions of yourself and the outer world and people around you, those things still live with me. And I kind of create, my own religion, my own mixture of things, given all kinds of things that I went through. And the last part is my family and my wife, which brought like a different ingredient from everything else, because all the other things that I listed, like where I lived and what I read and everything else, was very, it was like almost passive in a way. No one challenged my bubble in a way. It was just, okay, there's a book, I'm going to read it. This is my family. This is where I grew up. So it's like more of a river or a stream of being shaped as a person. And my wife is totally different than me. I wouldn't say 180 degrees, but very different than me. She grew up in a city-like environment and with different standards than me. And a lot more, I was a lot more forgiving to people and letting things slide a lot more. And due to my nature in that, which is part of the kibbutz and part of my overcomeness in a way, I lost opportunities as an 18, as a 19 years old, as a 20 years old. And without meeting her, all of this nice ideology and philosophy and everything, maybe I could turn to a person who's sitting in a room in the dark, writing very interesting books, but very, very secluded and not forward reaching and without a lot of forward momentum. And one of the things that she brought to my life, which I'm thankful to this day and probably to the rest of my life, is to be more active out there, pushing myself, challenging myself, getting out of my comfort zones, because all of this way of life, this stoic, this calmness, it's very easy for me. But the flip of it, of going outside my comfort zone, this is her part from when I was 18. Now it's second nature. It's 15 years together, and we have an anniversary tomorrow, 7 years together. So now I don't even think about it, but she was a huge part in shaping me. Mm. And vice versa.
There are a lot of parallels as I was listening to you there in my own life. In one sense, from the two worlds collide kind of a thing. And also, interestingly enough, when I was, I believe I was 16, I was going through some of my dad's shit in the basement. And lo and behold, I found some books. And there was Carlos Castaneda. And you
and me are the same age. So it's pretty, pretty interesting.
And there was another book as well. I forget the author, but it was called The Crack in the Cosmic Egg. And it was sort of about... It was about a lot of things. It was a very sort of book written in the 70s kind of a book. But the idea was sort of what you were talking about there, where you have this incubation period or this world that you're incubated in. And then something comes along and sort of penetrates that bubble that you live in. And at first it's just a crack, usually, unless there's some big overwhelming thing that comes in and just shatters your world. And that can be a very different experience. But, you know, you kind of look out and you go, oh man, there's all kinds of stuff out there that I didn't even know existed. And there's that fear of the unknown. And there's that exhilaration that comes with the realization that there's far more to the world than you thought that there was. And some of those maybe frustrations or concerns that you might've had that, is this everything that is in the world, immediately gets thrown to the side because you realize there's so much more to the world than you could even comprehend. And for me, that realization was a struggle. When I realized that there was an infinite playing field, it was a challenge to me because I was a clever child and probably a little too clever for my own good as a child, because grasping things readily and sort of mastering what was within my grasp as a child made me feel like perhaps I was going to be able to master everything. And then to realize that there was so much more to the world than I had anticipated and that I was never going to be able to master everything kind of threw me for a loop. But I guess in response to everything that you've said, I am perhaps most drawn to the idea that there are these conflicting forces. You mentioned that sort of in the intro, that you have this drive to do things and you have this desire to maximize your presence in your family and your influence there in a positive way. And you have to live in both of those worlds simultaneously. And in fact, they're inseparable in certain ways, but you have to exist sort of in a different mode in each of those places. And I can speak to that because I go through periods in my life where I might wake up and immediately the wheels start spinning about the things. And I've been dreaming about the thing I'm working on. And I wake up and I start working on it. And then maybe I'm doing other tasks, but I'm still thinking about it. And then to the second I go to sleep, which is too late in the night, I'm staying up and obsessing over something. And then, you know, 4 hours later, I'm awake. And for 3, 4 months, 6 months, a year, I'm just turbo charged on a thing. And for me, I have learned that I have to sort of not do that too often, because I am not good at balancing that world or that part of me with the part of me that is most important, I feel like, which is being a part of my family and taking on the role of father and husband in a way that is meaningful and is present. So I have to sort of check myself on those things and be very conscious about making sure that my projects or my passions or whatever are not shoving to the side the things that are most important to me, because I just have that kind of obsessive tendency. And I guess I'm wondering, you know, you have the project world and the family world, you have the kibbutz world, you have the out world, you have this sort of inner philosophical world, you have this person come along who challenges you to step outside of that world and see how much of a difference you can actually make in the world outside of yourself. And I'm wondering the ways in which you have been able to balance that and some of the things you've learned by that juxtaposition of those two sides of yourself and existing somewhere vacillating between those two, or you said superposition, but I guess I'm just wondering how that works out for you, or how you do manage to do that.
Sure. So I think it's a challenge to almost anybody that has like a drive or wants to achieve things. It's a common problem. Not for most people don't have it because they're okay with their way of living. They're not challenging their assumptions or how they live. But everybody that wants to break his egg is experiencing that, and it quadruples when you get family and kids. So it's a common thing. Now for me, I don't think there's a silver bullet to this. I think you said obsession. Obsession can be a very strong tool. The most successful people in the world are the most obsessed people. You look at Elon Musk and Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos. Those are very obsessive people. I think they are the epitome of how to live. But this obsession, this bug, is something that can be very fruitful to reaching your goals. For me, I think it's gonna be a bit cliche, but being here and being aware as much as I can, like right now when I'm talking to you, I'm here. I don't think about anything else, and I'm totally in the moment with you, and I'm listening to every minute word that you're saying and every small thing. I'm not thinking about my other projects. I'm right now not thinking about my wife and my kids. I'm with you. I'm in this. And when this is done in the best way that you can, and you can practice this, then the impact of what you're doing is a lot bigger. And when I catch myself just drumming the drums or just going through the motions of something that I want to do because I'm supposed to, then I feel that I'm wasting my time in a way. So if you would look at my daily routine or daily life, you wouldn't see someone working 15, 16 hours a day. You would find someone right now in this period of time working 8, 9 hours a day, sometimes even 6, 7 hours a day. And I have crazy deadlines I want to reach, and I'm going to sleep too late at night, and I wake up too early. But But I accept that there are phases, and now there's an odd phase of this pandemic worldwide, and everybody in the home, and the kids are at home, and everything shifted a bit in the last 2 months, and I accept this. I'm saying, okay, this is right now the flow of things. Let's see if what I can push and what isn't within my powers. Going back to Carlos, there's a strong moment that I keep repeating it to my head, and it's one of the things that stuck with me. Don Juan, who's the mentor of Carlos, takes him to walk through a mountain, and Carlos stops to tie his shoes because they got untied. And Don Juan stops, and he's tying his shoes. And at that very moment, a huge rock gets released from the mountain and drops a few meters after them or before them. And Carlos tells Don Juan, "We're so lucky that I stopped to tie my shoes. If I wouldn't tie my shoes, we would die." And then Don Juan tells him, "Yeah, but what if the rock hit us because we stopped, and we would have died because you stopped to tie your shoes?" And then Carlos he doesn't know what to tell him. He's really in a tough spot. And Don Juan says, basically, the moral of life is, or the philosophy of life is, you need to be flawlessly tying your shoes. That's pretty much it, which is, in other philosophies, it's being in the moment, it's being aware, it's doing the best that you can do. And understanding the things that are, there are quite a bit of things outside of your powers. That I can't modify the pandemic. My wife is in the first trimester. She's having a hard time. She needs my support. I can fight over it, or I can understand and accept it and push my energies in a different way. So it was a long round answer to saying, when I'm not in the just doing, I'm in the awareness phase. I know when I'm doing the right things for me and my family versus I'm just going through the motions of what I'm supposed to be doing. And luckily, in the past 10 years, I've gained myself some levels of freedom. So I don't have to do anything. I can pick what I want to do. And this is, I think, one of the major milestones that most people need to achieve. And obsession is a good thing to get to that, because I was a lot more, there were years of my life that I worked 16, 17, 18 hours a day. And luckily it fit in line with what my wife was doing at that time. So it was okay. There was no strain on the relationship due to it. And it gave me some place. I'm not like, I can sit with my legs in the air, but I have more degrees of freedom. I don't have a boss. I run a few businesses. I can play around with things. I have more leverage points. So I think this is how I manage those intricacies or these conflicts of interest in a way. Hmm.
There are a couple things about those Don Juan books that stuck with me. One of them is the idea of the will as a physical reality, that your will extends from your belly button. And when you attach to something, you manipulate the world physically in reality, and that you draw yourself closer to a thing with your physical will, that it's an actual force.
I don't know how he's calling it in English. Like your holding point or your collection point is going some kind of, yeah.
And I've seen it. you have to go to a certain place to see it, and I'll just let people kind of, they know who I am. They'll figure that out, but you can see it. And this sort of the second thing, I mean, there's a lot of stuff about those books that I pondered over quite a bit, and there's some malarkey in there, but there's some really useful stuff, and I often think that's intentional in any philosophical or sort of worldview stuff. It's you put a little bit of malarkey in with the good stuff because people have to decide for themselves what is valuable. But the other thing that has always stuck with me is Don Juan said, keep death on the left. And Carlos is kind of like, what are you talking about? I said, keep death on the left. You know, you have your will, and there are two sides to that will. And there's sort of the neuroscience wise, or, you know, physically, you have your left side of your body that's connected to your right brain, your right side that's connected to your left brain. And this left side of your body, this right brain, that's sort of your emotional instinctual part. It just is, you know, that's the side of your mind that processes things as they are, rather than trying to think their way through them and be logical about stuff. And the reality is that death is a reality. And Don Juan, they're walking through the mountains again, and Don Juan tells Carlos that he would never be in a position where he would fall victim to an accidental death or to be murdered by anybody. And Carlos says, well, what about if somebody's hiding out and they have a rifle pinned on you? And Don Juan says, I wouldn't be in the position where they could shoot me. And Carlos is like, what are you talking about, man? Says, well, that's not who I am as a person. I walk confidently and I keep death on my left. I just accept things as they are, but I never put myself in a position where I'm needlessly risking anything that's outside of the object of my will. And when I think about those things and the context of our conversation, number one, when I heard you talking about those books, I was just sort of thunderstruck because they're fairly popular books in a certain regard, but especially nowadays, hardly anybody has read them. Some of the younger guys have read them, and my friend Victor is one of the people who has read it, and you can tell. But okay, so I just maybe wanted to throw those ideas out there. But we've talked philosophically, we've talked a little bit of background, we've talked a little bit of idea wise, but I want to get into something a little bit more concrete for a minute, because when you talked to me about this, it was one of those moments where you go, well, how is this not something already? Why was this idea waiting for Adam? And I'm talking about Skipper, and I'm talking about it because, number one, a lot of people who listen to this podcast are very enterprising people, and a lot of them are younger. If the information that some of these podcast apps has given me is correct, a lot of people are in their 30s, which is really ideal in a lot of ways for the market that Skipper is looking at, because it's people coming into their own, maybe with a little bit of money and a little bit of ready to make their way into the world. So why don't we talk a little bit about this and what's going on with Skipper, what it is, how it works, and what you're envisioning with it moving into the future?
Sure. So a bit of a background before, so Skipper makes sense. I started a company called Razor Grip about 10 years ago, which is kind of like a software development agency. At the peak, we had about 30 employees. We worked on very interesting projects, from intelligence world to cybersecurity to everything in between. It was a very interesting 10 years period. And there was another two additional companies that I started like 6 or 5 years ago. And about 3 years ago, I was kind of fed up from the services world. And I always wanted to do products more than services. But an opportunity came, and me and my partner said, okay, let's sell the company. Let's sell Razor Grip. It's something that happens in the world. You sell your business. So we came across a broker in Israel. He was very experienced. He knew how to work with companies like ours. And he told us, we'll do a short process and we'll pitch you to our potential buyers. And probably within 6 to 9 months, if everything goes well, you sell your company. You stay for about 2 years to support this transition. And then you get your money. So the promise felt good. We started the process. We paid them some money. And at the end, nothing happened. We didn't sell the company. Razor Grip is still alive. But along that process of the transition of selling a business, and the pains I had around it, it was something that always stuck with me. And about a few months after that, I met a good friend of mine, who's now a good friend of mine. Back then, I met him through a mutual friend whose name is Shemi, who is someone that lived a lot in the States, and he did a lot of businesses and entrepreneurial thing. And he came to me with the idea of Skipper, which is basically a platform for buying and selling small businesses. And he told me about all the pains that he had from the buyer side, the opposite of mine, someone who's looking to buy a business and all the pains around it. And in that moment, it clicked for me because I saw a couple of things that were mind-blowing. One, only about 10, 20% of those transactions really happen. So imagine someone working for, not like me, for 5, 6, 7 years, but someone that's been working for 20, 30 years on his business. And after such a long period of time of supporting his business, he wants to retire. He wants to spend more time with his grandkids. He wants to transition. He's meeting a dead end. He won't sell his business, most cases. And on the other side, someone who's interested in being an entrepreneur and not starting everything from scratch, whether it's being always having a dream of having your own bar, or someone that's always wanted to open a gym, it doesn't really matter what it is. The pain of starting from scratch and the cost around it is enormous. So I immediately jumped on board into Skipper as the technical role in it. And we've been building it for the past 2 years. There are ways to find businesses just for sale in the States, but they're all very Craigslist style in their mindset. They're just like listing boards. You don't get to the phase where you, you want to check if this business, how it behaves versus its competitive businesses in the benchmarks. You can't really manage the inner working of putting an offer and putting the escrow. So all the process is broken. Now, if I zoom out from everything I just said, if you're a 30, 35 years old person that has about $20,000, $50,000, $70,000, and you're thinking to yourself, what am I going to do with this money? What's my next step? So basically, you have very limited options as categories. You have real estate, which is good. It's something that's been done for a while, and it's the safer route in a way, in most economies. You have the stock market, and you have all kinds of crypto, but that's it. There, for most people, this is the end of the list. And there's another category, which is buying a business. Now, unlike the other categories, that when you buy real estate or when you buy a stock, you hope that it will appreciate. You're gambling or you're guessing, this is underpriced. I think this will be worth more in the future. This is the premise of the investment. While when you buy a business or even a portion of the business, there's no guessing. The asset is already producing money, cash flow. So you can see exactly how it's been behaving for the last 2, 3, 4, 5 years in various periods, in various recessions or financial issues that might have been. And basically, you get money from the get-go. It's like an already paying dividend stock or a house that you're already renting in a way. And it's something that right now people aren't aware of, most people, 90% of the people. And it's something that's very interesting to me. And the third thing is it's the independence or sovereignty in a way. You have, I don't know what the figure right now, 30 million, 40 million Americans right now without jobs. Let's say 50% of this is just on paper, okay? They're going to go back. But there's still so many people right now without a job. And there are so many, and they basically, even if they try their hardest, they won't find a job because the small businesses are hurting. They went through a terrible time. Some of them will be closed. And one of the opportunities now is for those people to say, why won't I be my own boss? Why won't I have my own business, my own sovereignty in a way, in a field that I already know? So if I've been working in restaurants for the past 5-10 years, I know how to run a kitchen, I know how to run a ship. Why can't I be a restaurant owner? I don't need to put that much money into it. I can find small restaurants with minimal down payment. I can get financing for it. Well, right now it's hard, everything I just said, but one of the things that we want to do is solve that big gap. And this way, we really think that this liquidation of the market, if only 10% of the market of these transactions occur, 9% basically it's lost money. It's money on the ground because the business slowly fades and closes. It's something that can boost an economy and people in that economy tremendously. I know that I will never sell Razor Grip because of the conditions, because it's too late. Razor Grip was a good selling opportunity 3 years ago, and it didn't happen. And this is money gone. And if I had that money through selling Razor Grip, I could do additional things. I could do additional ventures. And this is from the seller side. So I think this big gap of opportunity is something that really excites me in the past 2 years. I always have additional things on my plate, but this is something that I'm really, really focused on because I see the momentum of it in the market and how it can change. We're already live with the platform. We started just a few months ago, going live and starting to get people in, both buyers and sellers. And we're tiptoeing around it because we don't want to mess up the experience of anybody in this process. We don't want sellers or buyers disappointed, because right now in the conditions in the market, they are disappointed. Mm-hmm. They go to listing boards, they don't get buyers. So for us, we prefer it takes a bit more time, but every new thing that we enable in the platform is good. It's stable. It provides value. So that's my skipper story.
So there are a few things in there that I'd like to touch a little bit more upon, because I live in Utah, as essentially everybody who knows me knows, because
you own Utah, man.
And I tell people that, that's right, it's mine. And if you're my friend, you're welcome here, but it's mine. But this is a very, very entrepreneurial place. The University of Utah is consistently in the top 5 to 10 schools in the world for having a student come up with an idea as an undergrad or a graduate student, and then converting that idea into a business rather than just writing a paper about it and getting their piece of paper and then going to work for somebody else or having the school rip them off, that kind of thing. It's very business oriented. I mean, there are a lot of housewives here who are selling essential oils. Multi-level marketing pyramid schemes are big here too, because there's a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of wives sitting at home. It's just sort of that's very much still a thing in Utah, though it's sort of transitioning a little slower than the rest of the Western world into the modern idea of two parents working. But there's a lot of people holding on to the husband works, the mother stays at home situation, but there's still the need to supply the kind of life that everybody wants to live. So there's a lot of stuff at home. And the reason I bring that up is because there are a lot of small businesses that get going and then get shut down here. There are bookstores, there are restaurants, there are CrossFit gyms, there are all kinds of things. And a lot of times there's a lot of churn. And what I have seen, because I've worked for some of these smaller businesses, is somebody invests, say, $100,000 into the business, and they're trying to get to positive cash flow, and maybe they get very, very close, but they just run out of gas. And they've already leveraged themselves to the gills, so they liquidate what they have, they file bankruptcy, whatever the case may be, and that business goes away. Where if they had $20,000, they could make the business work. They just needed to sort of get over that hump. And, you know, a pizza shop opens up and it's good pizza, and but the word just hasn't got out. And then whoever opened the business, they never get into the black, where they, you know, they can't meet their nut. And then you've got these $30,000 pizza ovens, and you've got this great location, and you've got all these recipes that were put together, and it's just gone. And if there were an easier way for somebody to say, I have this thing that I've made, I have this pizza shop, I have this really great idea that I've tried to make work, and I feel like I've proven the concept. I just ran out of money. I ran out of steam. Maybe I didn't anticipate I was going to need 2 or 3 years of money. I just thought I wanted my own thing, and I started it. If they could have a little bit more money, or somebody to come work with them and put in a little cash, put in a little extra effort. And that's one of the things too, that I wanted to talk about it, because, you know, you talked about real estate, and unless you're going to be an active property manager where you're renting out the places, let's say you just buy some acreage, and you think, well, in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, is it going to be worth 10 times as much? Or the stock market. It's like, well, unless I'm going to be a day trader, maybe I'm just putting my money in an index fund and going like this. But buying a business is not like that. You have to be in it. And for somebody who's 50, 60, 70, they're trying to get out of it, like you mentioned. But for somebody who's 30, and I've talked about this ad nauseum on this podcast, everywhere I go, you got to have a purpose. You got to have a mission. You got to have something that you are doing to fill your time that is meaningful, that is productive, because otherwise you tend to, for almost everybody, slip into a place where your life ceases to mean anything to you. And that causes some darkness to creep into your person. And it can have some seriously drastic consequences, including some of the most drastic consequences. So you have a little bit of money because you've worked hard and you've been smart, and then you invest it into a business, and then you got to show up. But you're showing up for yourself because you have stake in it. You have skin in the game now. And in so doing, suddenly all this stuff matters to you, because everybody, you know, almost everybody shows up to their job every day anyway, 5 days a week, 6 days a week, 7 days a week, depending on your situation. But most of those people too go, man, my boss is a dick. I don't really care about what I'm doing. And no matter how hard I work, I might get a raise, I might not, but I don't have any incentive to really do a better job or a great job other than the personal satisfaction. And if I come home and I have a good life and I'm doing enough at my job to not lose it and it covers my bases, then why would I? I can put my passion and my interest and my effort elsewhere. And that's sort of a losing mindset, but even so, it tends to be the norm. But if you have some stake in the game, if your business is more successful because you're working smarter, you're working harder, you're putting in a better attitude, and people are attracted to you and your business because of that, and then suddenly you have more money in your hand, you have more opportunity, you're better able to support the people that you love and your community and those kind of things, it suddenly means a lot more. And so I guess I'm wondering, sort of from that vantage point, your mission in a lot of ways is to help people find that meaning. You talked about how you have these businesses and now you have the freedom to, you can put an effort here, you can put an effort there. You don't have to just like bow down to somebody else's will all the time, unless it's you're serving them through your mechanism. And I know that you have found a lot of satisfaction in that, and that's part of what you're trying to enable people to do. And you know, you've tried to create opportunities for me and for other people, and I see you continue to do this outside of your business area. And I guess I'm just wondering how much of what I've just talked about is driving you, and how maybe you could just talk a little bit about how you see this opportunity creation mechanism doing that for people, and how that's going to work moving forward. Because you said you're tiptoeing right now, but when it's fully fleshed out and you're able to provide the service that you're ideally trying to provide, what does that look like, and what do you hope to be able to do with it?
Sure. So a couple of things you talked about. Just so everybody knows, the small businesses are running the world. We don't think about it all the time. We kind of think like, okay, it's Amazon, it's Google, it's whatever. No, 60, 70% of the GDP is small businesses created. 80% of the jobs are powered by small businesses. They are the real engine. they're just very small and separated, so you don't feel it, but they are servicing you. And this is, and it goes back to the to my mission and why it empowers me. If this group in its most critical stage in their life, which is do or die, or do I get to that exit stage or liquidation stage? This is basically the biggest financial point in a small business life. And this impacts the life of almost everybody around us in a way, because, and like I said previously, that business owner, that me, which I was lucky, even though I didn't sell Razor Grip, I was lucky, not just lucky, but I worked on it, but there was some luck around it that even though I didn't sell my business, I was able to do other things. And I think solving that scenario, that issue, and also from a financing aspect that you talked about, like someone needs that small money, he can't get it from the bank or from other lenders. But there are people that believe in this business, even people in this community. You go to a place that you believe in, you think it's going to be successful. You see its financial books. You understand it just had a rough patch. You see the potential outline, and you want to support it, but not to support it from a from a voluntary stage, but support it in a way that you think that it's a good opportunity. Then yeah, this opportunity is for you or others. Don't exist in the market, and I think it's a win-win-win scenario if they would exist, which is why I'm so drilled into that and I believe in it. Regarding being in the business or not, so yeah, 80-90% of the times you need some commitment, unlike real estate or other things. You can't just be passive about it in most businesses that you're part of. But there are quite a bit of businesses when they have a good operator, just like if you have a good management for real estate or other things, that it you're not in the day-to-day. I don't think it's relevant for most people when they first want to buy a business. It's something more advanced because you need to bring yourself into the business as much as you can at the beginning. And when you're in it as a business owner for at least once, you can maybe step back and say, okay, maybe now I'm more of an investor, less of and someone on the day-to-day things. For example, right now with Razor Grip, I'm very passive about this business, but it took me about 10 years to get there. It didn't have to happen 10 years, but so for people starting out in thinking about buying a business or a portion of a business, partnering up with an existing business, yeah, I totally agree. I think you should be boots on the ground, pushing hard, bringing your who you are and the value that you bring to this business. You don't have to go to things that you worked on. So for example, I don't know, let's say you're great at internet marketing, okay? This is your passion. That's what you've been doing for the past 5 years. You're a great copywriter. We know a lot of these guys. And you hear that, I don't know, laundromats are making a killing. They're making great money, for example. I don't know, in big cities, okay? Maybe in Salt Lake City, maybe in New York, where there are a lot of people that don't have a washer in their house, it's a good opportunity. But you're saying to yourself, how can I provide any value to this kind of business? So I think the biggest challenges small businesses right now have is digitization or going online. Most of the small businesses, even though we live in a technology-oriented world for the past 15, 20 years, and technologies all around us, a lot of them are not there. So you can bring, you know how to get this business online customers. You know how to make their language and their content something that appeals to a larger audience or a more dedicated audience. You can get that laundromat that up until now just worked on walk in from the street to start a subscription service in a way. So you can bring your talent to various fields, even if you didn't live inside of them. But yeah, but it's an even bigger advantage if you do know those businesses. So for me, I would personally not buy a restaurant or a bar. I feel like even though I'm an entrepreneur for the past 10 years, the value that I will bring into it is rather small. And I don't think I can make a big enough impact. Even though I always had a dream, even 20 years ago, that I would have a local bar with my friends, that every night everybody will come. That's okay, that's a nice dream. But in terms of practicality, this is something less for me. But if I would look at a service-oriented business, like, it doesn't matter what the service is, if it's someone that does plumbing or psychology or a consultation or a graphic design studio, doesn't matter what kind of service, I feel I can have a very good impact on a service-type business because I've been around service-type businesses for the past 10 years. So I think this went from me to someone who's interested in buying a business, but I think those two work together in a way that, for me, if people will find, and this goes back, I'm going back to the philosophy. If you find your calling in a way, and this is the mission, and your calling is, for me, the calling is bringing independence people and creating and reducing the amount of times that money is wasted away, generating liquidity in a non-liquid market, that I see how this impact is big. If someone's calling is, I know how to make services businesses successful, or I know how to make content beautiful and appealing, then you can find this output or this outlet not only in your own small island. There are many businesses that are hungry for this, not just as being your customers, but also potentially being partially owned by you or totally owned by you. Mm.
There was an idea I put a pin in and stuck it to my mental corkboard earlier, and I think this is a good time to bring it up. Because you had talked about how in your attempt to sell Razor Grip, you ran into some frustrations. And then when you met Shemi, he had some frustrations about being on the other end of things. And I wanted to dive into this a little bit more because there are actually sort of two ideas in there that I'm interested in fleshing out a little bit. What I have found or observed in the world is that there are sort of two ways to make your dent in the world or to find your passion or your mission. And it's finding what you're really good at and finding what you hate and applying what you're really good at to what you hate. So for example, you were talking about a service business or the digitization of some business that hasn't yet made that transition yet and where they've partially made it and they haven't done a good job. So you go to the website of the local laundromat and it looks like it's a website from 1994 and there's copy that's misspelled and doesn't get to the point and has no hooks. And you think, I mean, who wrote this? A fourth grader in 1994? I hate this. I hate this website. I'm never going here. Or you go, man, I hate this. Hey, dear laundromat, person who doesn't know how to make a website at laundromat.com, I can fix your website for you and for a fee, or I can fix your laundromat website for you for a stake in your company. It's kind of far-fetched right there, but I'm getting at is if I'm a good copywriter and I go to a website that has crap copy, I can laugh at it. I can scoff at it or not frequent that place, or I can offer to apply my skills and my talents to that to make it more successful. And I think that there's a big distinction there in the way that one looks at the world sort of generally, but also specifically in this world of business, which is that one can see a problem in the world and complain about it. One can see a problem in the world and get upset by it or one can take the sort of other branch of that binary, which is one can see a problem in the world and solve it. One can take a look at a problem in the world and go, how can I create a packaged solution that I can then unleash into the world and let people solve their own problem and they can pay me for that package, that kind of thing. And I think that's sort of, there are those levels of mastery that people often talk about. And one of them is just even noticing the problems within yourself and fixing them, or the problems in your world and fixing them. And then the next step is sort of, well, how do I take the solution that I've created or that I've learned and then teach it to other people or apply it to other people's problems? And then sort of the next step beyond that is, how do I train somebody to be what I just was, which is the person who creates these problems and then or creates these solutions to problems and unleashes them into the world? Problem, solution, teacher sort of thing. And I think oftentimes, especially in the academic world, you have somebody teaching solutions to problems who has never actually solved a problem before. They've just read the book about it and mastered the content without ever actually having applied it. And I'll just bring this one last point up before I sort of get your thoughts on this matter, which is that I've talked about this on the podcast before, but I like to talk about it because I think it's very salient. And it's that my great-grandfather, my father's mother's father, he started the drafting and engineering programs at Brigham Young University here in Utah. And he had a strong distaste for do-nothing engineers, for know-it-all but do-nothing engineers. And one of the things that he required for people to graduate from his engineering program was that they had a year in the field, because he didn't want these guys coming up with solutions that worked in theory but fell apart in the world. And so in order for them to be able to complete his program, they had to go work in the field they were interested in and actually get a feel for what they're going to be doing, so that he didn't unleash a bunch of dudes with his signature on their degree who are going to fail and cause problems in the world rather than solve the problems, which is what they came to learn to do. And so I guess with sort of that framework, I'm wondering your thoughts on the problem and solution paradigm.
Okay. So first of all, you said you're obsessed sometimes about solving things. So I'm an obsessive problem solver in a way. Doesn't mean that I'll work on a problem 20 hours, but if I see a problem, you said the different types of how you, what's your initial emotion around a problem. For me, it's excitement. Like the first thing that I encounter a problem, doesn't matter if it's a problem about myself, my family, the outside world, a website. I'm excited about it because I see, again, cliche, I see it as an opportunity, really. Be it a small opportunity for growth, for personal growth, or be it as a way to improve the world around me, whether it's a very small thing, like, I don't know, I could be in a taxi, or in a small business that provides service for me, and I feel that something is off, be it in something small, I'll jump into it and say to them, hey, maybe do this and that, maybe because I'm excited about solving. I see these inefficiencies or issues as something that's immediately drawing me in to saying, okay, what would I do? How would I solve it? Even in big companies, even if I look at Google or Amazon or Facebook or whatever, or Twitter, I keep seeing those things. This is my pattern recognition, problem solution. And also around teaching that you said, one of the things that I'm always thinking about, I have at least at any given time, 10 to 20 people that I'm working with, how can I accelerate their learning, their knowledge, their output? Because at the end of the day, I'm one person. And I know that if I can advance the people around me by 2x, 10x, then I'm going to get 100x the output of what I want to get. Leverage is a very strong force in the world, which I totally get. So I'm constantly around this, and I think this mentality or this mindset is very beneficial for me, and I think for everybody to be excited about problems and think about them and look for them. You don't have to be angry or with a negative emotion about it. Like you said, the thing that you hate, I don't hate problems. I think it's great that we have them. It's those gaps in reality that allows us to improve the world. So that's on that. I think this is how I walk through life, in a way, calm and enjoying every moment, including this moment, and watching those little dots or spots of things that could have been better. Like in this Zoom talk, I know how would I take this product Zoom and make it twice as much better, but I'm calm about it. I'm okay with it. So this empathy while determination, this balance between the two is what guides me. Where do I need to push and change something and take ownership, and when I need to just understand and let it go in a way. I see it. I notice it. I know how would I fix it, but it's outside of my reach right now. I can't fix the corona right now or Black Lives Matter, but I know what I would do. My mind is around solutions around these things. And this is like a very long-term plan. I do hope that I'm working towards it, that in 10, 20 years, I'll gain more leverage points, not in an exploiting kind of way where I want to be like an evil guy that dominates the world, like, I don't know, Bill Gates style. I had to touch upon it. But I do hope that in the future, this momentum that I started will continue. So I can take this mindset of problems and solutions and get to more and more scenarios where I release them or I improve them. Again, in the balance of not being someone that dictates how life should be. Like this is the slippery slope of power. Like people with power or leverage, they get drunk about it and they start think, how do I structure life in a way that makes sense to me? This is the danger point. So that's my mindset around problems.
We're getting into a space.
Just one more thing. You said about about your grand. If I could talk for hours about the academy world where I'm on the I studied computer science, but 70% of the people that work with me didn't have a degree, or I didn't want them to have a degree. I'm totally for. From the moment that I milked cows, I believe in being in the field. Like theory is nice, and I'm a very, like you said, both of us are, we like ideas, we like to think about concepts and abstracts. But there comes a moment where, okay, ideas are nice, but let's get our hands dirty. Or did that person really do this, or is it's just in his mind and theory? And I'm for the hustlers, 100%. The people that are not afraid to take action, to make mistakes, to try 10 times. These are the people that are making an impact, not the people that are just theorizing all life. Yeah.
So there's a... I too have that sort of... I can see the solutions to a great number of the problems, and I'm just trying to insinuate myself into the world in a way where I can begin to influence things to a direction where those problems can be solved on a broad scale. And I was raised in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. My father's parents were Mormon pioneers, and one of the central tenets of that religion is that in heaven, in the pre-existence, there was a fundamental ideological divide. You had God, the Eternal Father, who created this plan, the plan of salvation. And there were two different takes on it, Lucifer and Jesus Christ. And Jesus wanted to go with the plan as God the Eternal Father outlined it, which was to create existence, but to give the prime movers, human beings, the opportunity to choose whether or not to go along with the plan. And you would pass through a veil of forgetfulness where you had complete knowledge of the plan before you came here, but then you woke into a body and had no knowledge of what the plan was, and it was up to you to choose whether or not you were going to be the kind of being who was going to serve the plan or not. And you had Lucifer, whose idea was, why would you give them choice? Do you want the plan to be enacted or not? Force them to do it. Remove choice. Make them your robotic minions and enact the plan. And the idea is that, well, that's, you're missing the point, dude. And at the end of this ideological war, this war in heaven, one third of the host of heaven left with Lucifer and said, I don't want humanity to have a choice. I want the plan to be enacted in perfection. And two thirds stayed in heaven. And we've been cycling through this existence ever since, testing whether or not we truly want to be a part of the plan. And I struggle with that very same sort of ideological divide in my own head. And I know which side of it I stand on, but that doesn't mean that I'm not tempted by the other end of it. And that's sort of the fundamental ideological divide in the world today. Are we going to be sovereign individuals, or are we going to be guided by a collective will that removes choice and removes responsibility and pushes us in a direction sort of outside of that framework? And when I look at the world, I often think, if people would just do what I told them to do, the problems would be fine. They wouldn't be there anymore. But that's kind of, you're missing the point, dude, you know? And that's, and so what I have done and continue to do is, I have my own things that I like to work on, but I have insinuated myself into a great many networks and into the lives of some people who already have powerful networks, and I influence them. And I don't mean like I'm a, you know, an Instagram influencer and now you're buying a mini microscope that attaches to your cell phone because I posted it. What I mean is that I expose people to ideas or to other people, or I connect certain dots, and then I get to watch that unfold in the world, and I love it. I've seen ideas that I know for a fact I introduced to people go on to the cable news or go out into the defense sphere or go out into the these different areas that I'm connected with, and I see it, and I see it get broad appeal, and I go, I know that I did that. Because I had the conversation with the guy who just exposed the world to this idea and it took off. And I from time to time record these podcasts called Chance Rants, and I release them on the same feed, and I just rant about stuff. I get an idea in my craw and I just yammer on about it for 10 or 15 minutes. And in one of those, I said, I don't want to be the king. I want to be the king's counsel. I don't want to sit on the throne. I just want to talk to the guy who's sitting there and go, look, man, here's a good idea. And there's this kid, Kyle Moonlight. I call him a kid. He's in his 20s. He's a kid to me, but he told me a while back, he said, you know, I never told you this, but my company, King's Counsel, is because of that Chance Rants episode. I heard that and I thought that was a great name for a company. And he named his company. He's got soap and shampoos and stuff. And that's right there is what I'm, that's what I love. And the reason I'm trying to bring that up is, number one, just, it's just a fascinating thing to me, the power of the network and the power of the influence of ideas, and how if someone like me is a wizard, a Merlin connect to a bunch of Arthurs. You know, there's a lot of thrones in the world, but there's not a lot of people who can speak to those people confidently, and because they're intimidated by the status. But I'm not a jealous person. I'm not a status person. I'm not a materialistic person. I find value in different ways, and I like to spread that value. And that brings me to what I'm trying to get at here, is that in order to be the person that we've been talking about, the person who sees an idea and then solves it and then packages that solution and then trains people to disseminate that package solution and to become a problem solver. It's very difficult to become that kind of person if you don't have a purpose larger than yourself, because if you make it just about you and what you want, you're going to get to a point where you have everything that you thought you wanted, and then there's still going to be that gap between where you are now and death that you're going to have to fill with something fulfilling or be searching for something fulfilling. But if you can find that thing that matters to you beyond just your day-to-day satisfaction, if you can find that thing that matters to you beyond just, am I right now doing something fun or whatever, then you can begin to be the representative of that purpose, of that idea. And then you can sort of infect people with that idea in a mimetic contagion that spreads very much the same way as a viral contagion. And you can see that move out into the world and make an impact. And you can take the satisfaction of knowing that you did that and that that's going to continue to ripple out and that every moment is eternal and you just forever change eternal. And it looks like it's going to be a pretty big deal. And I guess what I'm curious about is, you know, obviously you're in Israel, and so whether or not you are sort of enmeshed in the Jewish tradition is something that's very front and center in the world that you live in. And you said you've sort of created your own internal thing based upon the ideas and experiences that you've had, but purpose has to be one of them. I can tell you're driven by purpose, and I'm wondering maybe just your thoughts on how a person might begin to look for or find their purpose and be the representative of a purpose or some mission in life that goes beyond just whether or not they have the stuff in their lives that they want or the momentary satisfaction, and how they can sort of find that deeper meaning that's going to leave an impact beyond when they return to the clay.
Sure. So first of all, also in Judaism, there's the concept of choice. It's something very interesting in all religions, that in a way in Judaism, it's there's the plan, but there's always given a choice. And there's the saying, the choice is given, but the plan is fixed, in a way. I'm probably not saying it the best way. And I think, like the King Whisperer, which maybe you should add this as a tag, I think it touches on something that I think is what I think is people should focus on, unlike what they see online. People see online or in the real world that entrepreneurship or success or getting to a mission or proving yourself, it's very inner focused or very egotistical in a way, very centered around your goals or success in a very material way, where if you switch it around to being more of a vessel, just like a vessel in religion or a vessel in everything that you, a vessel for your family, a vessel, like you're not the point that holds the thing. You're the point that in that network, the fact of life, you're the one that's letting the streams go as quickly as possible and in the most impactful way. So just like you touched upon it, like doing those small impact of things or it could be big, but not focusing around you in a way, which is counterintuitive to getting to success, but focusing on the problem or the world or the mission in a way will get you a lot further than what you want. So I could give an example, Razor Grip, doing software development, etc. I can focus around too much about what the company is, what the structure, what kind of service do we provide, who are the people in the company, what do I do, what's my role, how much money are we going to get next year, what's the revenue. I can go into that and never get out of it. I can be totally obsessed about that. But a different mindset would be, wait, who am I servicing? Why? What are their pains? What for? What's the real, just like I said about Skipper, I'm not focusing about how are we going to be a $1 billion company. I'm focusing around, wait, who are the buyers? Who are the sellers? What are their pains? So we're a vessel in a way. And the most successful companies in the world even if we don't like them, whether it's Uber for transportation or Airbnb for hospitality, they no longer hold the property in a way. They're just vessels. So Uber doesn't have a taxi cab. They just facilitate, just like you facilitate, people going from point A to point B. And Airbnb don't hold hotel properties or houses. And we will probably not own in skipper businesses. We're going to be a vessel. And going back to that person who's thinking about how he can be more successful or get to his mission, which I totally agree. You need to have a large mission. You don't have to have everything figured out. It's very hard to have a very long-term mission. It becomes something that's unreachable in a way, and it frustrates you and you're stuck. It's okay to have a more short-term mission, even a 3 years, a 5 years plan of where you want to go. And as you feel more comfortable in that, you'll figure out, okay, this is who I am. This is what I like. So I think that in 30 years, this is where I want to get. But you don't have to solve this from the get-go. And this, again, one of the things that I see people are doing by mistake. They try to figure out this very, very unforeseeable future, which is too far and too shady for them to figure out yet. And I think if you do that, and for you, I think it's obvious. You're the wizard. You're the whisperer. You're the one that touches on those things and releases those pain points. And this is how you facilitate. But for everyone, if someone would take a few moments to himself and think about his talents and how he can impact others around him and what does good to him and combine those things together to a bigger mission. And in that mission, when he goes from idea to execution, remove yourself as much as you can from the equation to gain as much as you want back. So again, it's one of those things that if you're too focused about yourself, you're not going to get far.
Say that again. Will you?
If you're too much focused on yourself, then you're not going to get far. If you're obsessive or focused around the outside things, people, environment, whatever it is you want to impact, then you'll reach your mission. And this is one of the big things that people are not doing the right way. And I think this is what people should do. Focus on the mission, the external part. The monetary gain, the success, you'll get there. As if you downplay it, don't put it on the top. You see all those stories about people that I'm doing 10K, 15K. So you see all those, and it's a good dopamine rush in a way. You're like, okay, it's fun. I want this in my life. But if you want something that goes through those stretches, those hard periods, you need something deeper. You need a deeper calling, even if it's a shorter time, deeper calling, and it needs to be external from you, not internal.
There's a lot there that if I had my way, people would consider. And I maybe just want to add a thought or two to that. And I think where we've gotten to here and this idea, this sort of collection of ideas, I guess, I think this is a good place to leave people thinking about and leave this as the idea that they walk away from this conversation from. And what I would want to add to that is whatever it is that you're doing, you are facilitating. You might not be conscious of that all the time, but if you're working in the trades, if you're a construction worker, your job is not to swing a hammer. Your job is not to frame a house. Your job is not to shingle a roof. Your job is to facilitate somebody's shelter. Your job is to facilitate somebody's feeling of home. Your job is to facilitate somebody's ability to live the kind of life that they want. If you work in a retail clothing shop, your job is not to sell clothes. Your job is facilitating somebody's self-expression. Your job is facilitating somebody's ability to feel confident in their person as they're moving through the world. And it's this sort of mindset. It's not just a mindset. It's the reality of what we're doing. We are facilitating. Our job as people is to facilitate ourselves and other people to be able to do what they choose to do. And that issue of choice comes there. And I guess what I really hope from my perspective that people take away from this conversation is that there are an infinite number of ways to live your life. And there are just as many ways to facilitate other people to be able to do that. And if you can find something that matters to you, and you can realize that there are other people out there who have that same issue matter to them, and you can facilitate their ability to do that thing or live that way or participate in that activity, the success that you'll find, sure, the monetary thing is nice, and that money is a facilitator. Money is sort of like the universal facilitator, but what you're really trying to do is to align your capacity with your intent. And when you can have those two things working in tandem, then you're living your dream life in every moment. And when you're conscious of the fact that you're doing that, then you have the ultimate life, because through that consciousness of the reality that you're living the life you chose comes the gratitude for your ability to do that. And that would be sort of my takeaway from this conversation. Even for myself, I remind myself of this every day, because I'm grateful to be alive, and I feel lucky to have the things I have in a certain sense. And I feel proud that I have made the choices in my life that have led me to live this life that I'm so grateful to live. And I think maybe that's the last thing I want to say is ego is important. You need to be the kind of person who believes in themselves, who believes that they have the ability to facilitate others to do the things that they want to do. Because if you don't believe that you can help another person, you won't do it. So you got to do what you need to do for yourself to be able to do that. But that's where the ego, that's where the purpose sort of ends. And then it becomes an obstacle rather than a facilitator. And I guess that's sort of my final point. And with that, I would wonder, Adam, kind of what, you know, in the context of this conversation and in our relationship and the people who are listening to this, what are the one or two things that you feel like are most important that you would want to leave the audience with to consider or to embody or to take away from this conversation?
Sure. Sure. So just like we didn't talk about it, but fear is the mind killer. Like, people are too afraid to take action, to change their life, to pursue their goals, to challenge themselves. Stop. Life is too short. The rock is coming. Like, you don't know, death is on the left. I personally, every second, even right now talking to you, I'm fully aware that it can come at any second, and I'm smiling. I won't feel any regret, even though I won't feel anything. But if I had like a 1 second left until that moment happens, I'm fulfilled. I'm here. So if you take this mentality as much as you can to remind yourself that death is on the left, just like you said, then take action. Don't live life in a passive way. It's sometimes it's hard to do, but if you keep reminding yourself, you can tattoo it. You can put a coin. I have a coin, Memento Mori, that I see every day. You can look at your kids and remind yourself. You could look at your elderly and remind yourself this. If you keep this in your mind all the time, you will cut the time by orders of magnitude to where you want to go. Mm-hmm. And your life is perfect as it is, really. Like, there are times you will not do things the best way that you wanted to do. And there are other times that you will feel at the peak of your game and everything flows your way and it's very easy. If you take every moment and understand that every moment is perfect and it's in its own, like you take it with the humility and gratitude that you just said, that you're a small piece of this infinite world of so many people around you, of so many things that are happening. You do your best. You tie your shoes the best way that you can, in the most flawless way that you can, and you accept the things that you can do and that you can do, and you try again, and you smile, and you take the calmness that you've gotten so lucky to be here, and I've gotten so lucky to be talking to you, that everything else is a bonus. It's the icing on the cake. And that's what I would, if people would keep those mentalities of life is too short, I will stay in my awareness and I'll be here in the present. I think everything unfolds after that. All the minute details, all the tactics, all the strides goes from that.
Beautiful. I think that's a great message, and I think that's a great place to leave it. So thank you very much, Adam, my friend, for taking the time to come and talk to me and to share your wits and ideas with my audience as well. I'm grateful to be able to present people like you to the rest of the world and have them exposed to some of the valuable insights that you have within you.
It was a pleasure, man. Really.
Why don't you tell them your Twitter handle and tell them where they can find you on the internet?
Sure. So I have a funny handle when I was a gamer 15 years ago. It's called Cool Pirate, KUL.Pirate, Twitter. And you can go to skipper.com, which is not like you would write Skipper as it is. It's SKKIPER.com. You could look at things, and if you're interested, you can register yourself as someone interested in buying a business, or maybe if you're a business owner, then maybe exploring that as well. And I'm accessible. I love talking to people. You can talk to me about anything from technology to entrepreneurship to things that you're contemplating with. I'm enriching my life through these, through talking to people. So feel free to reach out about anything, really.
And I can testify to the veracity of that claim. Adam's been a good guy to talk to for me. And look, man, is there anything else you want to hit upon or touch upon before we wrap this puppy up, kick it out the door?
No, I'm good, man. It was a pleasure again. And that's it.
Well, in that case, I've been Chance Lunsford. He's been Adam Pillead. This has been the Logos Centrifugal Podcast, and this has all been allegedly, and we're out.